You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We have a really special Friday show for everybody today. I am so excited to be bringing back to the show historian Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor at Boston College, an expert on the American Civil War and Reconstruction, the author of 7 amazing books, and the author also of the number one Substack, Letters from an American, with over 1 million subscribers. We're going to talk a little bit about most current events, but also we're going to get into some tax policy, the history of tariffs in America, because there seems to be a lot of bullpucky being flown about or tossed about this. After Heather, and she's going to be with us for an entire hour, I'm also really humbled and excited to have for today's episode of Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, Fatima Goss Graves. She is the CEO of the National Women's Law Center and one of the co-founders of Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. You're not going to want to miss that. And of course, rounding out today's show, as it is Friday, we'll be joined by Civic Media's very own Terry Barr to talk about what's good local and overlooked in Wisconsin. Some good news to send you all off into hopefully a beautiful weekend. But welcome back, Heather Cox Richardson. It's a real pleasure to have you.
Maggie, I am so thrilled to be back here again. And as you know, I could not turn down the opportunity to talk about tariffs because it's not actually something that comes across the radar screen very often.
Well, it is front and center these days. But let's start with, there were a couple of major headlines this week. One that struck me on a very positive note and the other which lit my hair on fire, which seems to be happening all of the time. But I wanted to start with what I thought was a really bit of both historic and good news. And that is that the Atlantic magazine took what for the Atlantic is an extremely unusual step this week and endorsed Vice President Harris for president. This has happened very rarely. Tell us a little bit about why this is so notable, Heather.
Well, it jumped out to me because this is the fifth time in its history since it was formed in 1857 that the Atlantic endorsed a presidential candidate. And it has, in fact, endorsed all the opponents of former President Donald Trump. It also endorsed Lyndon Baines Johnson in 1964 and, crucially, Abraham Lincoln in 1860. And the reason that matters is because the Atlantic rose in the 1850s as part of a new form of media when it felt that the old media, the established media, was too much in the pocket of the elite enslavers, that it had ceased to push back, it had ceased to defend American values. And it was one of many, it was a magazine, and there were a number of newspapers that also formed in that era, including, by the way, the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the New York Daily Tribune, that set out to be the voice of people who stood against the slave power. So when they endorsed Lincoln in 1860, in a very long, incredibly, I hate to say it, but dry piece written by a very famous poet, and dear God, he had to show everything he'd ever read. It was a big deal because they said, you know, You old media that say we shouldn't be talking about this stuff and we shouldn't be standing up for American democracy, you're just wrong. People need to stand up for democracy. So they endorsed Lincoln in 1860. And when they endorsed Kamala Harris on October 10th of 2024, they harked back to that. And they said, you know, we're supposed to be a nation of free thinkers. We're supposed to stand up for democracy. We're supposed to care about these things. And they were taking that forward to endorse Harris. But I thought implicit in that was a criticism of the established media today, which really seems largely to give former President Donald Trump a pass on what is really extraordinary behavior. So I thought there was implicit in that a criticism of established media and also a recognition that there's all kinds of new media in this era that might be taking over the scene.
We like to think here at Civic Media that we may be part of that new media wave. Your piece and your reflection on this struck me as incredibly timely, not just because of the historic nature of the Atlantic's endorsement and the fact that they explicitly hearken back to their endorsement of Abraham Lincoln, but because there seems to be this recycled, I believe, untrue story or line of attack levied against Vice President Harris, that she's, quote, not taking interviews. And excuse me, you dug into this a little bit, utilizing this historical context of old media versus new media. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, and actually a lot of the examples I used in that piece were from Noah Berlatsky, who was writing in Public Notice a few days before that, or maybe even that day. But I don't think what he was saying was unique. There has been this idea that somehow Vice President Kamala Harris has not been having public interviews. And first of all, you know, nobody paid a lot of attention in the established media to the 3.5 years in which she has been in office. And that's pretty normal because you don't really pay a lot of attention to the vice president unless something really bad happens. So it's kind of the job of the vice president to be invisible. But she was actually very, very active in those 3.5 years. She was traveling all over the world, made a lot of appearances in places like Indonesia, pushed a lot of the administration's policies, and then domestically really spoke for younger people and women who cared about reproductive rights. She had this tour around the country that was like a rock star tour, and also was always at the forefront of protecting the idea of equality before the law. So when the Tennessee Three got tossed out of the legislature in Tennessee, she was there. She was one of the first, yes. Not one of, she was the first national person there. So she has very much been there, even though that didn't get a lot of coverage. If you were paying attention, you knew that she was not some cipher. She's always been there. But since she became the Democratic nominee, since President Joe Biden decided he would not accept the nomination, she actually has done a lot of established media. She's done CNN with Tim Walz. She's done 60 Minutes. She's, you know, she's been out there. But she's also done a lot of media that is not traditionally thought of as the established media. So the National Association of Black Journalists, she did a big interview on a Hispanic channel. She has been very much out in the world, but not in places that necessarily have that ring of we've been here for a century. So the Call Her Daddy interview, I thought was absolutely fabulous, a podcast for a younger generation. She did The View. She did Stephen Colbert. She did Howard Stern Show. And just those four things alone reached about 25 million people that aren't necessarily reading CNN or the New York Times. And I think it's been a deliberate strategy on her part, in part because those established places like the New York Times are really looking for a gaffe. They're looking for something that will get clicks. And the others are looking more for her to explain what she's doing to a different population. So I think it's been deliberate, but I also think it's a reflection of where the media is right now in what seems to me anyway to be a pretty dramatic split between old media and a new media with a different kind of agenda. So it's a really interesting moment to be watching.
Indeed, I have been troubled since Donald Trump's golden elevator appearance about the kid gloves that apparently I think are used very frequently by mainstream media. It's only really been, in my opinion, in the last couple of years where you see interviewers asking the tougher questions and trying to follow up. Again, in my opinion, it stands in marked contrast to a lot of what you see even in British journalism from their very mainstream outlets, the BBC included, where follow-up questions and tough interviews are to be expected, as are fact-checking. All of this, of course, they're talking about Kamala Harris not doing these interviews. Donald Trump, of course, failing to appear on 60 Minutes because he was whining about potentially being fact-checked. It seems such a double standard. And this fact that you included in your reflection yesterday in Letters from an American, Heather, I thought was really emblematic of this phenomena that we're talking about. You wrote this, that Matt Gaetz of the media watchdog Media Matter reported that the five major newspapers, LA Times, New York Times, USA Today, and the Wall Street Journal, as well as the Washington Post, produced nearly four times as many articles about Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton's email server in 2016 in the week after then FBI Director James Comey announcements than they did about the unsealing of the new Jack Smith indictment of Donald Trump for fomenting an insurrection and interrupting the peaceful transition of power.
It's crazy. It's crazy. And I mean, I think there's a number of reasons for that, but it really stands out because, of course, the final report on Hillary Clinton's use of an email server, which almost nobody saw, and it was a little bit hard to find. You had to go in through Chuck Grassley's portal from his website.
Yep.
Said, you know, basically there were the usual slips, but there was no crime committed. There was no there. And yet that got four times the coverage of the new indictment or the new version of the indictment from the grand jury, a different grand jury than the first one that that indicted Donald Trump for trying to overturn an election and erase American democracy. And, you know, I, like you, there's so many things that seem like they are earth-shattering.
Yes.
That don't seem to get any coverage. And I don't know how people think, I don't know how journalists, not even journalists, I don't know how editors think that voters are going to be able to make good decisions about the future of the country if they don't have in front of them things like, you know, the guy's a criminal, has been found liable for sexual assault and, you know, found guilty on 34 counts of crimes. I mean, I don't know how you're supposed to figure that one out.
Yeah, a lot of false equivalency going on. We're going to dig into one of those absolutely incredible headlines that seem to appear and then disappear as if it wasn't really a big deal that dropped this week with my very special guest, Heather Cox Richardson, historian and professor at Boston College, author of the Substack, Letters from an American. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Keep on running because the winner don't quit on themselves.
Welcome back, Wisconsin, or welcome if you're just joining us. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. My special guest for this Friday episode, for the entire first hour, is historian Heather Cox Richardson. She is the author of the Substack Letters from an American and a professor at Boston College. Welcome back to the show, Heather. We were just talking last segment about the historic endorsement of Vice President Harris from The Atlantic. And as you talked about that in your Substack yesterday, we went on to discuss the media's treatment, the mainstream, the old guard media's treatment of Vice President Harris and the seeming lack of accountability from many mainstream media outlets as to Donald Trump's prolific lying and the dangerousness of his lies. I just want to read a bit from The Atlantic, and then I want to talk about one of the things that came out this week about the former MAGA president's behavior and decision-making that I think is really scary. Here's from The Atlantic in their endorsement of the vice president. Harris, they are endorsing her, The Atlantic said, because she, quote, respects the law and the Constitution. She believes in the freedom, equality, and dignity of all Americans. She is untainted by corruption, let alone a felony record or a history of sexual assault. She doesn't embarrass her compatriots with her language and behavior or pit them against one another. She doesn't curry favor with dictators. She won't abuse the power of the highest office in order to keep it. She believes in democracy. These and not any specific policy positions are the reasons The Atlantic is endorsing her. They referenced currying favor with dictators. And earlier this week, I had thought I had heard almost all of it from Donald Trump's obsequiousness to dictators around the world, but most especially Vladimir Putin, and how completely contrary to any traditional conservative viewpoint that would be. Ronald Reagan rolling over in his grave, I am certain. And yet we found out this week with the publication of Bob, or the upcoming publication of Bob Woodward's book, War, that Donald Trump sent COVID tests. And back then they weren't the little nose swab tests. These were much more involved tests when there were not enough COVID tests in the United States to give out to Americans. This, in my mind, when I read that headline, was absolutely stunning. This was Senator Chris Murphy, as you reported in your Substack, quote, "What has this country come to if the revelation that Trump secretly sent COVID testing machines to Putin while thousands of Americans were dying, in part because of a shortage of testing machines here, doesn't disqualify him to be president?" The revelation, in my opinion, is damning, and yet it seemed to get reported on and disappear into the media frenzy ephemera. You went to talk about this, as well as the revelation coming out of Sheldon Whitehouse's persistence in getting information about the Brett Kavanaugh lack of an investigation, frankly, the handcuffing of the FBI by the White House at the White House's direction. There was never any fulsome investigation of the sexual assault allegations against Brett Kavanaugh. To me, these two items of news this week are absolutely incredible. And again, they seem to have fallen away. Tell folks some of your thinking about this, about what you think this points to in our moment coming up to the November 5th election.
Well, two things really come to mind. And the first is that I think one of the reasons that these things tend to appear and then fade very quickly is because there's so much. Like, you just, both of the things that you identified are things that would be the end of an administration in any normal era. And there are times when we get several of those a day. So it's a little hard to sit there and say, well, what is today's most important? Oh, I got to keep reminding people of this. I got to keep reminding people of this. And Trump did a very good job of sort of poisoning the well for any discussion of his connection with Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, by insisting that what everybody was talking about was a hoax. It was not. I mean, the Republican-dominated Senate Intelligence Committee said absolutely, yes, Paul Manafort was working with a Russian operative. The Russians and the Kremlin worked to put their finger on the scale for Trump over Hillary Clinton. I mean, this is not stuff that's coming from somebody wearing a tinfoil hat. This is the Senate, right? The Republican-dominated Senate Intelligence Committee, kind of the best of the best, right? So there is, first of all, that I think just too much coming at us all the time, and we can't stay on top of it. And it, not just that, I mean, one of the things you didn't mention was the Supreme Court's extraordinary decision in Donald J. Trump versus United States, in which they said that the president cannot be prosecuted for crimes committed as part of his official duties and should be given a presumption of innocence in other duties as well. That overturns all of American law. I mean, that's just, that is mind-boggling, and certainly overturns the very principles of the framers, that there should be nobody above the law in the United States. That was how why we started a country, you know? So there is, I think, just that so much comes at us all the time. But there is something else, I think, related to that. And that is that one of the things that really helps when you have all this stuff coming at you all the time is to be able to step back and say, what are the patterns that I see here?
Yes.
And people like Anna Applebaum, who is a scholar of foreign affairs, but a very deep thinker, or all the way back to James Comey, gave a very important speech in when he was director of the FBI in 2014, I think it was, in which both of them have talked, in which he said, but Anna Applebaum has talked about it as well, that we are no longer looking at a world that is divided by religion, say, or by forms of government, but is rather setting up axes to have authoritarians on one side and democracies on the other. And Trump very clearly is trying to shift our weight from democracies into authoritarians.
And the prospect of the corruption here is intense. The through line of burying an investigation, of currying favor with dictators, and on top of that, a lack of any adherence to ethical norms is stunning and disqualifying. When we come back, we're going to dive into the history of tariffs and tax policy with my very special guest, Heather Cox Richardson, historian and professor at Boston College, here on The Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
It's funny how money changes situations. Miscommunication lead to complication. My emancipation don't fit your equation. I was on the humble, you on every station. Someone play young Lauren like she done. But remember not to game the one of the sun.
Everything. Welcome back, Wisconsin and beyond. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn, host of The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. My very special guest this half hour is historian Heather Cox Richardson, author of 7 books, as well as the Substack Letters from an American. She is a professor of history at Boston College, focusing on the American Civil War and Reconstruction. She's also taught at MIT and UMass Amherst. Really happy to have her. Folks, you're going to want to stay tuned through the whole show today. At the top of the hour, I'm really excited. I'm going to be joined by Fatima Goss Graves. She is a co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund and the CEO of the National Women's Law Center. That promises to be an incredible conversation. You won't want to miss that convo either. But to pick back up where we left off, Heather, we were talking about the potentiality and the likelihood, frankly, given all of the available evidence of corruption within a second Trump administration, supercharged by the Supreme Court's immunity decision. And one of the cornerstones of his economic policy proposals, his tax policy proposals for a second term, are tariffs of some 20% on all imports and 60% on Chinese imports. He's told the American public again and again and again that China will pay for these tariffs, that other countries will pay for these tariffs. And as you put it in your Substack this past October 5th, that is a deliberate lie. But let's hear it from the man himself. Jess, if you would play the former MAGA president's comments on McKinley.
We're going to be doing a lot of things, but we're lowering taxes. We're going to use tariffs very, very wisely. You know, our country in the 1890s was probably, Marcia, probably the wealthiest it ever was because it was a system of tariffs. And we had a president, you know, McKinley, right? You remember Mount McKinley? And then they changed the name. But one of those things, he was really a very good businessman, and he took in billions of dollars at the time, which today it's always trillions, but then it was billions and probably hundreds of millions. But we were a very wealthy country.
Wow. There's a lot of history here. We were talking before you came on the show that some of the language that's being used today to talk about tax policy, some of the language invoked by the former MAGA president, is eerily similar to language that was used
in our country's past over this very same debate. We had effectively moved away from tariffs as a fundamental source of revenue to fund our federal government following the Great Depression, largely in response to the massive needs and the demands of working people and the middle class. But the history of tariffs started much before that, Heather. Help us begin the beginning. Why is Donald Trump invoking McKinley? Was it a good idea back then? Was it working for working people when we first deployed tariffs in this country at a massive scale?
Well, it's just so interesting to hear anybody actually talking about McKinley. But the important thing to remember when we talk about tariffs today is that Trump is really not talking about economic policy. He's really trying to invoke this idea that he's got this magic solution, and he's harking back to this era that he thinks was so great when he says America was so rich. Well, if you think about the Gilded Age, the people who were rich were the robber barons, and ordinary people didn't have any protections in the workplace. They didn't have any minimum wages or maximum hours. The reason we have the word mangle is because a mangle is an iron, these two heavy superheated rollers that smash together and iron things very, you know, very quickly. The rollers are automatic. And if you caught, you're a worker in one of those factories and you caught your fingers in the rollers, your arm would get dragged in and it would be destroyed. You would be mangled. So this is what he is harking back to and saying was this fabulous time. And in that time, the tariffs, these giant tariff walls around the country did in fact protect industrialists. But what they enabled them to do was to collude to raise prices because they didn't have any foreign competition. And they also swallowed up all the small entrepreneurs in the country. So what he's really talking about is throwing all the economic power and political power in the country to a very small group of oligarchs. And as we were talking about before, he's made it very clear he would rather align the United States around the world with authoritarians who have this sort of oligarchy around them than to continue to press American democracy.
That right there, Heather, is the core of why this is so frightening to me. It is, he wraps this pseudo-economic policy, which isn't an economic policy, in the trappings of populism. But it is the very antithesis of tax policy that will actually assist a vibrant, growing middle class, which is necessary for a capitalist democracy. People need to have purchasing power. And it harkens back to a time where the wealth inequality in this country was absolutely staggering. Right. And we have now exceeded those inequality metrics, those inequality levels of the Gilded Age. Just a bit of data to add to our conversation here. From 1948 to 1973, productivity, worker productivity in this country increased 97%. And over that same period of time, hourly wages increased 91%. That is a reflection of the New Deal policies coming out of the Great Depression. It is a reflection of moves away from these industrial protectionist tariffs that existed before that time, and a move to a progressive income tax to fund the federal government. If we look at what has occurred with those same metrics since 1973, we find that productivity still going up by an incredible margin, 72% since 1973. And yet, in that same period of time, hourly wages have only increased 9.2%. That differential is staggering. We're effectively entering an economic period that is very analogous to what led to the Great Depression, especially if these sorts of protectionist policies are able to take hold under a second Trump administration. I stumble over the word trust, of course, because what we did after that was trust busting. We had to break up these monopolies that were exploiting workers and driving wealth to the upper echelons, the top 1% back in that time.
Well, I think that there's a little bit of a caveat about what you said in that the Biden and Harris administration has worked very hard to combat that extraordinary wealth exchange. So from 1981 to 2021, that is Reagan to Biden, about $50 trillion moved from the bottom 90% to the top 1%. And he worked very hard to reverse that. But what you said about taxes, I think, is very important, because this idea of tariffs does go hand in hand with taxes, because what happened is in 1913 under Woodrow Wilson, the government ceased to rely on tariffs to pay its revenue and instead started putting in place a progressive income tax. Now, Trump, of course, has called for getting rid of a tax on the wealthy and on corporations and replacing it with this extraordinarily high tariff. And what he keeps saying is that China is going to pay for these tariffs. Other countries are going to pay for these tariffs. But in fact, the people who pay the tariffs are the consumers at home. Now, in the 19th century, people were very aware of that, and they actually called the tariff a tax on working people. And it was on those grounds that they called for getting rid of the tariff or lowering the tariff. And Trump sort of elided that so people don't recognize that what he's saying is we're going to make the wealthy and corporations stop paying taxes, and we're going to replace that with a tax on American working people. And it's very, very clear that that's what's going on.
According to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, a report that just came out earlier this week, it's a nonpartisan organization. They analyzed the impact of the totality of Trump's tax proposals on each income quartile of the United States. And what they found was that Trump's tax policies, if enacted, would result in a reduction of tens of thousands of dollars for the top 5% of income earners in the country. And every other quartile, the rest, the 95% of the rest of us, would see our taxes go up. That's the root of this. I wanted to ask you a little bit about some of the language, the rhetoric around this. You wrote on October 5th that McKinley defended these extraordinary high tariffs that helped enrich monopolists and the steel magnates and these monopolies and trusts and the robber barons by calling them, quote, indispensable to the safety, purity, and permanence of the republic. And Republicans, as voters started to demand a movement away from tariffs to taxes, attacked that as being socialism, as adopting a socialistic approach. They doubled down on this. They said this, quote, to create a red welter of lawlessness as fantastic and as vicious as the dream of a European communist. Certainly has echoes of today, does it not?
Isn't it astonishing? There's nothing new under the sun. But the, you know, one of the arguments that they made in the late 19th century, I think you also see the echo of in this moment, which is that a few good people should run the economy and should run society for everybody else. And that was the idea, that you wanted to concentrate wealth and power among people like the Andrew Carnegie and J.D. Rockefeller, because they were the ones who really know how to make things work. And you see the same thing today. The reality, though, is that in a democracy, theoretically, we believe that everybody is created equal and has a right to be treated equally before the laws. That is, the economy should not be rigged in favor of the very wealthy. And we have a right to have a say in our government so that we can make sure the laws do reflect a broader interest. And you know, we're fighting the same fights today that they fought in the 1890s.
It's truly incredible the parallels that can be drawn. And again, you can find some of those parallels in my very special guest Substack called Letters from an American. Her name's Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor of history at Boston College, specializing in the American Civil War and Reconstruction. When we look again at that period in the late 20s and early 30s, Republicans again went back to tariffs as a policy solution. And this is the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, despite the fact that voters had been saying, we don't think this is working. It's not working for working people. It's making the rich richer, and it's not improving the middle class at all. And in June 1930, Republicans passed that Smoot-Hawley tariff. Help us understand, how did that happen exactly, right? Because, we end up talking about the Electoral College again. How did that happen exactly, and what was its impact?
Well, the Smoot-Hawley tariff was an attempt once again to double down on this idea that if you built high walls around the country, industry would develop and it would be able to raise prices for work, you know, be able to raise wages by having higher prices. So that was the idea. But of course, what happened was twofold. The first was that other countries promptly slapped tariff walls on the United States. So world trade really slowed way down at the same time that they were not able to get dollars to pay back the debts they owed after World War I. So it's going to lead pretty directly to World War II. But at home, what the tariff did was it essentially created price rises for ordinary Americans at the same time they did not have enough buying power to sort of prime the pump and get the economy going again, because there just weren't enough people making enough money to buy things. And this is why we get a real embrace of Keynesian economics in the 1940s, by at least 1940s, but played with in the 1930s by a slightly different name. The idea that you really should put money into ordinary Americans and have policies that make sure ordinary Americans make enough money, because they're the ones who buy stuff, so that the economy will keep on rolling along. And that's exactly what Biden has done, and it's worked.
And we find ourselves again in a time where productivity and income inequality is exploding and workers' wages aren't keeping up. We're going to come back with some final thoughts as we discuss the history of tax policy and tariffs in this country with my very special guest, Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College and author of the Substack Letters from an American. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
It's so silly. You just lost one. You just lost one. You just lost one. You just lost one.
You lost one.
You just lost one.
It's so dumb.
You just lost one. You just lost one. You just lost one. What a bum bum.
Welcome back, y'all. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're continuing our discussion with historian Heather Cox Richardson, author of the Substack Letters from an American, as well as seven incredible books. Just wanted to add in a little fact, which I thought was fascinating, given our discussion, which all of you can find. My first interview of Ms. Richardson, that you can find at civicmedia.us. That is the Maggie Dawn episode from September 27th. We spent a lot of time that day talking about the Electoral College, and you mentioned in your Substack earlier this week that in, I believe it was 1884, voters by popular vote had elected Grover Cleveland, basically on the promise to lower tariffs and use income taxes to help fund the federal government. And Mr. Cleveland didn't become president. Mr. Benjamin Harrison did, because of the Electoral College, and they went back to more tariffs. Just a little interesting bridge between our first conversation and this one I wanted to share with everybody. One of the things that I think is extraordinarily important to help people understand is why Donald Trump would pursue economic policies that every economist of any objective merit knows would not work for the middle class, that he's doubling down on the tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans that he helped pass in 2017, and that led to many trillions of dollars of increase in our deficit. Like, what actually is the motivation there? Of course, there's some self-interest, himself being a ridiculously wealthy person. But to me, there seems to be more than that. And if we bring this conversation back to sort of where we began today, Heather, this likelihood of corruption, this fascination with dictators, what do you think voters need to see? What is the big picture here?
The big picture, I think, is exactly that. And we've pointed to it a number of times, that Trump does not defend democracy, nor does J.D. Vance and the MAGAs who are supporting them. And it's important to remember that these are not your mother's Republicans. These are not traditional Republicans. They are radical extremists, are looking, and they're quite vocal about the fact they want to overturn democracy. They do not believe democracy works. They believe that it corrupts a society by permitting secular government. They believe that you need to get rid of it altogether and instead to concentrate power among a very few people. And I think Donald Trump is on board for that because, first of all, he wants to stay out of jail. But second of all, he cares about money and he cares about power. But a very small group of Americans who want to impose Christian nationalism on us are also behind it because they, too, don't believe in democracy. So when you look at things like Trump's cozying up to Vladimir Putin or CPAC's cozying up to Viktor Orban of Hungary, who got rid of his own democracy and put an authoritarian government in place. What you are seeing, I think, is the attempt to destroy American democracy at home and then to align the extraordinarily powerful United States of America with dictators so that the people who are in charge of this country can concentrate wealth and power amongst themselves. And anybody who thinks that that's going to do any good for anybody except a handful of Americans or a handful of people is simply not looking at the bigger picture.
Yeah, it's a lie, and it's a pernicious and dangerous lie, one where these weird alignments of interests seem to, again, be coming together to threaten the very basis of our democracy. Again, you pointed out in your Substack of October 5th that by 1929, 5% of the population received one-third of the nation's income. Today, the top 1% of earners in the United States took home in 2023, 27% of the nation's income. We are back to those Great Depression levels of acuteness. If you can speak, Heather, in our last few minutes here, to folks who may be traditional conservatives, independents, people that are pro-business, what would you say to them about the choice that's presented this November 5th?
Well, you know, I always say that I'm a Lincoln conservative, and people wonder what I mean by that. And that's that Lincoln recognized that if, in fact, we were going to be a conservative country, we had to stand firm on the Declaration of Independence. For the simple reason that when you start to say that some people are above the law, it's only a question of time until there's a very small group of people in charge of the country. And when they are in charge of the country, they have no reason to treat the rest of the people equally. And what they will do is they will be corrupt and they will concentrate power among themselves. So if you're a small business owner and you think you've got a great idea, good luck with that. Because unless you are cozying up to the dictator, you're not going to get anywhere. And even if you do, it can always be taken away. And this is what's happened in Hungary and obviously with Vladimir Putin. So anybody who really cares about maintaining American democracy and the sort of center level of guardrails that have protected our economy, but also our rights, cannot side with the MAGA Republicans right now. And one of the things that I always think about when I watch the MAGAs in this moment, so fervently supporting Trump, and this seems weird, but I always think about the Confederates, because in that case, the leaders of the Confederacy who were trying to convince the followers in the South that they were, you know, all in this together and that they would be protected, guess who was on the front lines and guess who ended up losing everything while those extraordinarily wealthy people stayed in power? And that, you know, that's worth remembering that we've done it here already. Mm.
Thank you so much, Heather. It's always a privilege and pleasure to talk with you. That's Heather Cox Richardson, historian, professor of history at Boston College, author of 7 books, as well as the number one Substack, Letters from an American. I can't wait to talk with you again. Folks, you're not going to want to go anywhere. I'm so excited to talk with my very special next guest. Her name is Fatima Goss Graves. She's the CEO of the National Women's Law Center and a co-founder of Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. News, weather, and sports are next. Keep it.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.